become so, he has so much wisdom to share, but yet he puts it in terms that all of us can relate to, and they share with our clients or our family or whatever. And then this was not even asked for, and he got treats.
I brought treats, and I'll talk about the treats at the very end.
But Sean, thanks for being.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for having me back. So let me turn off these lights so we can see the slides a little bit better. And I said to Lisa that I'm recording this right now, so I'll send her the MP3 file of it to share with other people who weren't here, if you want to listen to it again or something like that. So I'm going to talk about power foods tonight. And what I did was kind of did a top 10 list. I do a lot of media interviews, and the magazine, you know, typical magazine thing, you know, Prevention, Cosmopolitan, like the sort of fitness beauty magazines always want to do stories about, like, what are the healthiest foods? What are the superfoods? And so, like, I've been sort of putting this list together over several months maybe, and this is my top 10 list, right? The foods that I have on here are the healthiest foods, or the power foods, because there's good research on them for longevity, or for antioxidant, or for anti-inflammatory, or for blood sugar control. Some aspect of metabolism we can really point to and say, yep, this is good, this is how it works in the body, this is why it's giving you an anti-aging effect, or a general wellness effect. So stop me as we go through any of these if you want to talk about any of them. So I've got 10 foods, I've got maybe 15 total slides, and then we'll talk about the snacks that I have up here, because these snacks are going to be a study that we're going to do here at the Treehouse in May, June, July-ish time frame around the idea of controlling stress. So the general idea here is that the reason bad foods are bad for us is typically because they interrupt one aspect of metabolism. They're causing too much inflammation, they're causing too much oxidation, too much glycation, which is blood sugar fluctuations, or allostation, which is a cortisol imbalance kind of an idea. So if you eat the wrong foods, such as too many refined carbs, too few fruits and veggies, too many inflammatory fatty acids, and not enough of the anti-inflammatory fatty acids. Basically, the you guys know what SAD stands for? SAD? Standard American Diet, right? That's the In-N-Out Burger stuff we were talking about before we started. That leads to faster aging. Stress leads to faster aging. And when I talk about stress, I'm generally talking about, you know, psychological stress that you guys have heard me talk about before, but also cellular stress, which is imbalances in any of these. But the sad thing is that the way most people eat, you know, not getting a fruit or a vegetable in an entire day, and then gobbling down a big fast food dinner at night because they haven't you know, fueled themselves properly all day, you'll not just have one of these, you'll have an imbalance in all four of these. And that's sort of the worst of all worlds, because very often what happens is if you get a little bit over inflamed, it causes oxidation in the body. If you get a little bit over oxidized, it interferes with your blood sugar control. If you are under stress, it can interfere with all of those. So it's very much like a dominoes game. It's a cascade effect. So if one's out of balance, the other ones are probably out of balance. But the good news is that once you balance one of them, it starts to rebalance the others. It's as if you're setting up the dominoes instead of knocking them down. So if we eat more anti-inflammatory foods or more blood sugar controlling foods, it can give us an effect on the cellular stress. It can give us an effect on the antioxidant effect, right? So the better we can be at picking a little bit of all of these 10 foods, the better off we're going to be. All right? Does that make sense to everybody? Okay, that's sort of the 30,000 foot view of it right now. So the number one healthiest food is black beans, for a lot of different reasons. Does anyone know this concept, the blue zones? Okay, so Blue Zones, really, really good book. The author, Dan Buettner, does that sound right? Did a very good research project. Went around with National Geographic around the world to find the longest lived societies on the planet. You know, so this is people eating a Mediterranean diet. This is people eating a traditional Asian diet, like Okinawa and Sicily are sort of the stereotypical diets. They ended up finding, I think there were 7 very long-lived populations. You know, they had a very high percentage of 100-year-plus people in that population. And what they did was looked at what did they do? What were they eating? What did their physical activity look like? What did their social networks look like? And those places with the highest lived populations are called blue zones. The one thing that all of these 7 had in common was some sort of bean or legume at the heart of their diet. And I picked black beans because there's a good sort of scientific reason we can say, all right, is it kidney beans? Is it you know, some other kind of bean? I picked black beans because as a nutritional biochemist, I can point to these. I can say it's really high in protein, it's really high in fiber, both soluble and insoluble, and it's really high in phytonutrients. Specifically, the reason that black beans are black is the same reason that blueberries are blue and blackberries are black, because of that very high concentration of these flavonoids called cyanidins or proanthocyanidins. They're good for the heart, they're good for the brain, they're good for generalized blood flow. So they're anti-inflammatory, they're antioxidant, they're anti-stress, they're blood sugar controlling, all in that one food. It's the one food I wish more people ate. Why don't more people eat it? Why don't more people eating the standard American diet eat black beans? Because why? They don't taste good. Yeah, they're one of the reasons that they have kind of a bitter flavor is because of those proanthocyanidins. Those flavonoids have a bitter taste to them. There's another reason.
People like the gas. Right?
The gas. Yep. Does anyone in here eat a lot of beans? Your body develops a tolerance to them after a while, right? You'll be able to eat a little bit of beans, get a little bit of gas. Eat more beans, get more gas. But after a while, you eat more beans and you get less gas because your body's able to digest that. There's also the fiber aspect here is really important for gut microbes. It's really important not just to give you bulk to your stool and help you eliminate things and help keep you regular, but that prebiotic fiber, that soluble fiber, helps our good bacteria thrive, and so they can push out the bad bacteria. So that's going to make your gut health better. If your gut health is better, your brain health is better. If your gut health is better, your immune system health is better. It's a very interconnected system. And that's one of the reasons that if you have this in your diet, if you have black beans or beans in general in your diet on a consistent basis every single day for years and years and years, you live longer, your body works better, your mind works better, you're sharper, you're firing on all cylinders because all of those things are connected just because you're including this food, right? That to me is just nearly miraculous, but we can document that kind of stuff. Yeah.
For these power foods that you're bringing up, is there like a minimum effective dose on how? I mean, I know you might not be able to pare it down that much.
That's a great question. Yeah, like how many servings of black beans do I need to have, or you know, how many servings of fatty fish do I need to have, or berries, or whatever? There isn't a minimum effective dose, right? It really is but there is probably a. There's probably a cutoff point where you have to say, like, more isn't necessarily better, right? So if you're 0, that's bad. If you eat them once a week, that's going to be better. If you eat them twice a week, that's going to be better. If you eat them every day, that's going to be better. There's probably a point where, you know, beans once a day is probably the plateauing part of the beneficial effect. If you start eating them, you know, 3 times a day, is that going to be any better? Probably not. Like that's kind of hard to do. With fatty fish, we know a little bit, which is the next slide. We know a little bit more. More specifically what that minimum effective dose is. what people really should be shooting for is 3 servings of fatty fish a week. That's a hard ask for a lot of people. And one of the reasons is, for some of the same reasons that people don't want to eat beans, they don't know how to prepare them. They don't necessarily like eating them just plain, you know, so because the texture, the mouthfeel, the bitterness, that kind of thing. Look at the fatty fish that we have here. Mackerel, bluefish, trout, tuna, wild salmon. Those are not the most popular of the fish choices, right? What are people eating when they eat fish, right? You feel good about yourself. You pat yourself on the back because I ate cod, or I ate tilapia, or I ate haddock, or I ate fish sticks, or I mean, whatever, you know, hooray, I ate fish. But none of those white fish are the ones that are high in omega-3s. These ones taste fishy because of the omega-3s. And this is one of the problems with it, is that, you know, it's a very strongly flavored fish because of that high content of omega-3s. And you guys know the omega-3 story, so I don't have to go into this in too much detail, but highly, highly potently anti-inflammatory. Partly because if you're having a piece of fish with dinner, you're probably not having a hamburger or a steak, right? What's high in that steak or that beef? What's that?
Saturated fats.
Saturated fats, omega-6 fats from the corn that they're fed. So the fact that you're switching out an omega-6, which tends to be inflammatory, for an omega-3, not only you're getting the threes, more threes, you're getting less sixes. So you're changing your ratio there. Yeah.
What about grass-fed beef, though? Because I always eat grass-fed beef because supposedly it has more omega-3s. Does it even come close?
Doesn't even come close, yeah. So I mean, that's a step in the right direction, right? So, you know, you could eat the corn lot kind of fed beef, and it's going to have a lot of omega-6s. You could eat the grass-fed that are doing a couple things. They're not eating corn, so their omega-6 load is going to be lower. They're eating grass, so their omega-3 load is going to be higher, and they're also more physically active, right? You know, the ones eating grass or walking around the field and that kind of stuff. So they're going to have a better ratio, but it's not even close to what you're going to see in a fatty fish.
Fish is just too expensive. You eat a lot of food.
It can be expensive. Yeah, it can be. This, you know, so I'm a big advocate of omega-3 supplements. I take a fish oil supplement every single night before I go to bed. The bottle of it is right there next to the sink in my bathroom upstairs.
Do you have a capsule or?
I do a soft gel. I take a brand called the company is called Nordic Naturals, and the specific product is called Ultimate Omega. And I take that one. I have no affiliation with the company, but they make a really good purity oil for a low price. So you can get a higher purity oil at a higher price, and you get a lower purity oil at a lower price. But that one, in my opinion, I think hits the sweet spot in terms of price per milligram of omega-3.
Is it possible to, kind of what Greg was saying, is it possible to overdo it on fish? Mercury and that kind of thing?
Yeah, and that's one of the reasons that taking the supplements is a good idea, right? So that 3 servings a week that I just mentioned, that's the sweet spot for omega-3 intake. If you're doing that and you're eating, you know, you're eating tuna one day and bluefish one day and wild salmon one day, you're getting fish that are high on the food chain, so you're getting more mercury, you're getting more PCBs, you're getting more of that kind of stuff. And so, you know, if neither one of you guys are a pregnant woman, so it's not, you know, it's not a problem for you from that perspective, but you still don't want a load of those heavy metals because they're going to be bad for your neurological balance, it's going to be bad for your nervous system, it's going to be bad for lots of things. So again, that's one reason that omega-3 supplements are good, because they're purified and they don't have those sort of contaminants. Yeah.
Well, as far as price goes, canned tuna is very cheap, but I don't know, what's your opinion on canned tuna?
Canned tuna is the same, you know, same sort of limit. You know, most World Health Organization statistics, right, will say don't eat that stuff more than twice a week, right? I love tuna, right? But you know, you get bodybuilders, for example, are really notorious for saying I'm going to eat a can of tuna every single day because it's, you know, that's just a gob of protein for them, right? But it can be a high mercury load too. It can be a high load of a whole list of heavy metals, you know. So good, but you know, other ways to get your omega-3s too. Yeah?
When you say three servings, you mean 4 ounces, 6 ounces, what is a serving? Depends from man or woman.
It's 3 to 4 ounces,
okay.
But that's about the size of your palm, right? And that's all you need. It's not like a gigantic plank of fish. How about farmed salmon, right? Wild salmon is something that you'll see this listed on menus and things like that. And to your point, very expensive. The salmon that most of us have access to in a grocery store is almost always going to be farmed salmon. Avoid it, don't avoid it. Is having no fish the worst? Is having farmed salmon better, or is it just as bad as having none? Do you guys have an opinion on that?
It's worse. I've seen the documentary that was just horrible.
Yeah. It's kind of, it's a crapshoot out there. There's some farm operations that are really good, and there's some farm operations that are terrible. Some of the farmed salmon are fed chicken meal, right, as their source of protein, which is not high in omega-3s. It's high in omega-6s. It's a sort of a non-sustainable food source. Salmon shouldn't be eating chicken in the first place, you know. So there's some of that, and then they're given chemicals to help pink them up because they're not eating, you know, they're not eating the astaxanthin and algae and things like that that a wild salmon would. So it's hard to say black and white farmed salmon is bad. I know there's some people who say that, but there are some good farm operations out there. Right now it's kind of the wild west right now. So it's hard to know what you're getting. So wild if you can is the better choice. But let me say, I think the farming operations will get to a point where they'll be really good once somebody emerges as the leader. Because, you know, people will say like, oh yeah, wild salmon is way better. How do you know what that salmon has been doing, right? Wild salmon, it could have just swam through a sewer. I mean, you know what I mean? So, anyway, so fish should be the second one on there. And so in those long-lived populations, fish was the number two thing that was common throughout all of those diets in the centenarians.
Is there a way you can overdose on omega-3? Because, there's a guy who's a really big powerlifter. He actually touts taking an extra pill every day.
Yeah.
So even if you get up to, 7, 8, 9, basically until you get to the runs.
Yeah.
That's like your omega-3.
That's your signal. I got the run, so I'm at my limit. I need to back it off one pill. Is that the? That's great.
Back off to 6.
Yeah. No. You can get to a high enough level where your blood gets so thin that it's not going to really clot, right? So you cut yourself and you just bleed and bleed and bleed like crazy. I tell people to shoot for 2 to 4 grams a day, right? So that, for me, I take, when I say that, I said before that I supplement every night before I go to bed, I take 2 of those Nordic Natural Ultimate Omega soft gels. So that gives me about, 2 to 3 grams a day, and that for me, I feel, is a good amount. I used to work with a guy, another scientist, who would take 8 to 10 grams a day, so he was more on this level, and I was just like, that, I think, is to the side of diminishing returns, you know? I'm not sure that you're getting that much more benefit at that high level than what you're getting at that low level, okay?
John, I think
yes.
You have to be careful, too, that you have to, the quality, I mean, there's obviously gray area, but a lot of people are taking fish oil, and the quality isn't good. So the percentage of the good oil that is in that tablet or that soft gel, it's not really fish oil, it's the bad oils. And I was surprised. I went through the drugstore one time and compared. I was amazed.
Yeah.
Some were more saturated oil than they were fish oil.
Yeah, and one thing that people fall into the trap of is, and I see people do this all the time, is that they'll go to Walmart or Costco or Sam's Club or something like that. Not to fault those stores, they're all about giving you value for your dollar, right? But they'll sell you a bucket of fish oil that has, hundreds and hundreds of soft gels in there. By the time you get to the bottom of that jar, you're eating rancid oil, right? So you're eating omega-3s that have spoiled, and spoiled rancid oil is actually going to increase your inflammation. So you're supplementing with an inflammatory oil at that point instead of an anti-inflammatory oil. So, you know, another reason, like, buy it in a 30-day supply or maybe a 60-day supply and make sure you go through it.
The same with the black beans. Black beans, some of them have lots of added sugars. You look at a can, a lot of them have added sugar, but you don't necessarily want adding.
Whole grains. I know it's not politically correct these days to talk about carbohydrates as a good thing. And you guys laugh, of course, because you know better. But whole grains are really a great source of B vitamins. They're a great source of fiber, which is going to be good for some of the reasons that I said before with the black beans. Good for digestion, good for glucose control, good for giving the healthy bacteria in our guts the kind of food that they need to grow and thrive. And then these very specialized carbohydrates that you don't really find many other places in the diet, lignans and glucans, that really help to prime the immune system to be as active as it needs to be. So that it doesn't stimulate the immune system, that's a different kind of an effect, but priming the immune system lets your immune system kind of be better at surveillance against bacteria and viruses and things like that. Okay, so, you know, a couple servings a day of whole grains, whether that's coming from a whole grain cereal, whole grain bread like you see on here, whole grain pastas, which are kind of an acquired taste for a lot of people because they're a little bit chewier and a little bit bitier. Oatmeal is probably one of the best whole grain sources. I eat a lot of oatmeal. Oatmeal is one of the key carbohydrates in these cookies that I'm going to talk to you about in a little while. But there's lots and lots of different kinds of whole grain sources that are out there. One of the problems that we have now with bread sources is a lot of people think that they're gluten intolerant, right? Anyone know about what percentage of the population is gluten intolerant? Yes, definitely less than 10%, right? The numbers are 1%, 2%, 5%, somewhere in there, depending on your definition of what constitutes gluten intolerance. But it's not everybody. It's not, you know, the food industry, packaged food industry. It's a buzzword now, right? One day, once upon a time, it was low fat, right? So the food industry says, yep, we can do that. We can make low fat. And then it was low carb. Yep, we can make low carb. Then it was gluten free. Yep, we can make gluten free. You know, so it's a trend that a lot of people are excited about for certain reasons, but if you don't have a gluten issue, if you don't have celiac disease, and you don't necessarily get a problem when you eat gluten, there's no problem with the gluten protein, right? It's not a dangerous protein, right? Most people digest it perfectly fine.
How does
yeah.
it manifest if you are intolerant?
Yeah. So you know, if you are intolerant, most people who are intolerant are gonna notice after they eat something like bread, they're going to get bloated. They're going to get a rumbly belly. They're going to feel sluggish. Some people will actually get kind of a rash on their skin, right? Those are the sort of hallmark effects. If you get a rash on your skin. So I have a good friend who said to me, I think I'm gluten intolerant. And I said, pah! Ridiculous, right? And she said, I went through the whole thing. Do you get tired after you eat bread? Do you, do you get gas? Do you get bloated? Do you get a stomach ache? No. And what she did get was she got this rash on her elbows, right? Classic sign of gluten intolerance. So she wasn't getting the GI, or she might have been getting GI, but wasn't sensing it, but she was getting this rash. And so her manifestation of her immune system not doing well with that protein was showing up here, right? Dry, flaky elbows, basically. And so she went off of it, and she feels great. You know, now her energy is back. She was low in energy, and she wasn't sensing it because she's always been low in energy because she's always been fighting this. And when she got it out of her diet, it was great. But she's one of those less than 10% of people where it makes a difference for. You know, it's kind of fashionable now for people to go, oh yeah, I don't do gluten. Well, why? You know, if you don't have a reason to avoid it, then you're cutting out a big portion of all these healthy sort of nutrients. Okay? Hi. Okay, dairy. Are you guys surprised this is on my list of top 10? Sometimes I'll put this up and I'll literally get people go, ugh. because they're anti-dairy. I'm pro-dairy because I can tolerate dairy very, very well, but I'm in a family where we're half and half. My wife and I do great on dairy. Neither one of our kids do very well on it at all. My son, when he was little, we would give him, you know, smoothies and milk and all kinds of stuff, and he always had a runny nose and a red nose. My wife said to me one day, you know, I'm the nutritionist, and she says to me, I wonder if he has a problem with dairy. And I was like, ah, pff, ridiculous. You know, you and I, no, we're fine. Courtney, no, she's fine. And we took it away for a while. Runny nose went away. He's sort of grown. He's grown out of it since. He's a teenager now, and he can tolerate it perfectly well. But my daughter, about 2 months ago, read an article and decided, you know, self-diagnosed herself and said, you know, I think that my skin breaking out is because of dairy. What do you think, Dad? And of course, I went, pah, you know. And she said, well, I'm going to go off of it anyway. Skin cleared right up. You know, within a month. So, you know, there is that sort of individual variability, and even in a family. So the reasons that I like it, though, best source of calcium out there. Not for bones, right? That isn't why I like calcium. I do like calcium for bones, but I like it here because it's a metabolism enhancer, right? You're not gonna burn more calories if you take in more calcium. But if you're calcium deficient, there's a body of evidence that shows that your metabolic rate will be lower than it ought to be. Okay, so calcium somehow is permissive for your body to burn as many calories as possible. Good source of vitamin D because it's fortified with vitamin D. But this is where a lot of people get their key source of vitamin D, which is profoundly anti-cancer. It's anti-depression. It's vitamin D does everything. Does anybody in here supplement with D? How much do you take? Do you know how many IUs you take a day? 6,000, that's good.
I just had it tested.
Yeah? Okay, good. Anybody else take a different level? You take it about the same level? 10? Okay. I take 5,000 in the winter and 2,000 in the summer. And here in Utah, what is it now? It's the end of April. I will switch probably 2 or 3 weeks. I'll switch from my 5,000 to my 2,000 because we'll be starting to get enough sunlight where you'll be making enough vitamin D where you don't have to have the high supplement levels. But you need to get it tested, right? You get a blood test every once in a while, make sure it's right on target, because if it's low, not only are you going to have bone problems, but you're going to have problems with energy metabolism, you'll have problems with mood, you'll have problems with a lot of things. So another reason that I like dairy is because it's a really good balanced blend of different kinds of proteins and different kinds of carbohydrates. The reason that you guys have heard this before, that chocolate milk is the best recovery drink out there, right? This is why, because you've got slow and fast proteins and you've got slow and fast carbohydrates. So on the protein side, what's the slow and fast? What do I mean by that? Casein is a slow digesting and a slow absorption protein. And what's the fast one?
Milk, I don't know.
Whey.
Oh yeah, that's great.
Yeah. So you're getting a fast delivery of protein with the whey, and you're getting a slow sort of a drip, drip, drip delivery of protein with casein as your body digests that a little bit slower. On the carbohydrate side, you've got slow and fast sugars. Do you guys know which ones those are? So what's the sugar in milk that a lot of people can't digest very well? Lactose, right? And so if you can't digest lactose, you need to get lactase milk that has the enzyme in it so it's pre-digested for you. That's a slow digested sugar. And the fast digested sugar in chocolate milk is the added sugar, is the sucrose that they add to sweeten it up. So you're getting a fast sugar to replenish that glycogen and those blood sugar levels quickly after you've had a hard workout. And you've got a slower sugar that's going to be just similar to the casein, slower digestion, slower absorption, drip, 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 and sort of, give you that energy later after your workout is over. Think you want to go for non-fat? Do you go skim? Do you go 1%? Do you go 2%? Do you go whole? Whole. I can't do whole. Just from a personal preference, I don't think it's necessarily bad, but it tastes too much like a milkshake to me. I do 1% because that's just enough fat. 2% would probably be better from a, why do you want the fat in there?
Makes it taste better.
Makes it taste better. That's one reason.
We all need fat.
That's vitamin D.
That's a good point. That isn't what I was going to say, but yeah, vitamin D is a fat-soluble vitamin. You want to have some fat in there so you absorb it better. It's really an absorption issue. If you have a non-fat, it's gonna these proteins and carbs are gonna absorb a lot faster. And you wanna, you know, the whey and the sucrose are gonna be fast enough. You don't need to have a non-fat background. If you have a little bit of fat in there, you're gonna slow it down a little bit. You're gonna have better blood sugar control. You're gonna have a better overall satiety effect in terms of this keeping your appetite down for a longer period of time.
So what's more effective if you're using pretty much any type of recovery supplement, specifically chocolate milk? Should you be drinking a little bit before and during your workout? As well, is that more effective, or is it better just to take it all at the very end?
It depends on what your goal is. I prefer people after their workouts to go for at least half an hour without eating anything. And the reason for that is that, you know, a lot of our clients are working out to lose fat. And so if you have a hard workout and you refuel yourself immediately after, what you're going to do is you're going to put your body back into sort of restoration mode, right? I think if you go for half an hour or longer, your insulin sensitivity is still really, really high from that workout. You're going to be burning more calories. You're going to be in more of a breakdown, burning energy situation before you start refueling. You know, there's among sport nutritionists, there's this sort of this meme, right? It's repeated over and over again that you need to, as soon as you finish your workout, within that first 2 hours, you have to very, very quickly refuel yourself. That's important if you're doing very hard two-a-day workouts. It's vitally important. If you're going to have a morning workout and then a very similar afternoon workout, you got to do that. Most people aren't doing that, right? So I think it's more important for most of our clients that are working out once a day, give themselves that period of after their workout where they're insulin sensitivity is high, they're burning a lot of calories, their blood sugar fluctuations are going to be a good thing for their fat burning, then refuel so they can go the next day. Does that make sense?
So
yeah.
About that whole, and maybe you said this, but like out of your history,
yeah.
You know, you always hear for protein synthesis,
yep.
To put on muscle if you're trying to get bulky.
Yeah.
Are you still saying half an hour?
Yeah, well, if your goal is to build muscle and lose fat, I say be hungry for that half an hour. If your goal is only to build muscle, to bulk, then eat immediately after. Okay? If you're a Tour de France rider, right? And you have a 4 hour ride, and then you have a 4 hour ride tomorrow and a 4 hour ride the next day, you're going to want to fuel boom, 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 boom as soon as possible, right? So in that situation, it makes perfect sense. But that elite athlete is not who most of us are working with. Okay, yeah.
What about quality of the milk? Are you, whether it's organic or not?
Yeah. Or organic or traditional or conventional, I guess would be.
There's so much.
Yeah. I buy the Winder milk because I like the way it tastes. It's just a total taste preference for me. I don't buy the organic milk, right? And it's to your point that you made earlier about cost, right? I stand there at the dairy case and I go, well, there's the Harmon's milk and that's $2 a gallon, and there's the Winder milk and it's double the price, but I like the taste of that and it's a gallon and it's a lot of servings, so I can justify that. And then I look at the Horizon milk and it's double the price of that. I'm not willing to pay that. You know, I don't think that the whole growth hormone thing is a real issue, you know. So like those organic milks will say, you know, not from, you know, from cows, not treated with bovine growth hormone. I don't think there's very good evidence that conventional milk has any of that residually in there anyway. So that's not a concern for me. Do you guys have a different thought on that?
I did a dairy tour of Cream of Weber when my daughter was younger. Mm-hmm. They were trying to kibosh that whole theory of we don't have hormones in our milk anyway. What are they talking about? We're paying so much more money for this milk. And they would tell us, the knockoff brands of Cream of Weber, that you're paying more for that brand, but really the harmless brand is Cream of Weber. But I've been confused by that because... So is there hormones in it? They say no.
Yeah, I don't think, I've never said, I think it's a smoke and mirrors thing, okay. Right? I don't think that there's good evidence that exists. The one area that I am a little concerned about is antibiotics, right? So dairy cows in particular tend to get given a lot of antibiotics, right? There's a lot of bacteria around the farms when they, you know, when their udders are swollen with milk, there's a high chance of them being infected. There's all that kind of stuff. So I'm more concerned about that kind of thing. That's one of the reasons that choosing a local, sort of a smaller dairy, you're less likely to get into that. So, yeah.
So I've done a lot of reading on this because I was the same thing. And what I learned was that the antibiotics given to cows are given because they're fed corn. And cows are not traditionally supposed to be eating corn.
True.
In fact, they're supposed to be eating grass. So what happens is when they eat corn, then they start to get issues, digestional issues. So they give them they pump them full of antibiotics because they're getting sick. And what happens when a mother who's breastfeeding eats, you know, something? It comes through the milk. So in my case, I've chosen to go organic because I know that the antibiotics are going through. They've tested actually the urine of cows that has come out into the soil and out into the ocean. And there's all sorts of, you know, information out there. So I choose, particularly with fat, anything fat from cows, because a lot of that fat, that antibiotics is stored in the fat, or any of the toxins are stored in the fat. I tend to go organic with like my meats and my dairy just because of those reasons.
Yeah, the antibiotic thing is a much bigger, scarier issue than the hormone issue. And part of the reason is that if those antibiotics are in the milk or the meat or, you know, whatever food source, that's going into our guts and that's causing, you know, disruption of our gut bacteria. So it's happening in the cows, it's happening in the chickens, it's happening in the pigs, it's happening in us.
We're having digestional issues, we don't have any more gut flora. I mean, you know, we get these like super bugs. I mean, it's all linked, you know, whether you want to believe it or not. But I mean, there's a lot of information that I've read has convinced me of that fact, you know. But I mean, you got to do what you got to do.
Yep.
Because it isn't.
There's another hand over here. Yeah.
Just one question. So, I mean, I like to include dairy. I like the protein, the fat, everything that's included with it.
But yeah.
I basically went a 2-year stint of my life without drinking milk.
Yeah.
And without eating much cheese and anything like that. And when I try to kind of start doing it again, I get worse. I get very bad stomach issues.
Yeah, yeah. I'm not surprised actually. Do you know why he's having that? Do you guys know why?
I'm just kind of
lost some of the bacteria.
Probably not that you did lose something. It's not gut bacteria.
Because I've been taking probiotics and a few things like that.
Yeah.
Despite that, if I take heavy amounts of dairy.
Yeah, so just taking that break, you'll probably never be able to go back to eating dairy the way you did before. Because by taking that break for, do you say a year or 2 years? So 2 years, that's enough time for your body to say, hey, there's no dairy coming in here. Why are we producing all this lactase? Why are we producing these enzymes that we don't need? If your body's not using those, it's not going to produce them anymore. Once you stop producing them, you're unlikely as an adult that you're going to reproducing them. Exactly, and that's probably why you're getting those issues. Yeah, you know, there's some people that actually make a pretty good case that as adults, we shouldn't be taking milk at all anyway, right? It's something that, you know, it's to help babies grow, and babies make a whole lot of lactase to, you know, break down mother's milk. Same thing for cow's milk. But then as adults, we lose the ability to make that enzyme, and we should stop taking this as a food source, you know? So you could make that case, but, you know, one of the reasons it's on this list is because in those high-lived, long-lived populations, they do eat a lot of dairy. They eat cheese, they eat, and without getting into the whole, you know, pasteurized, non-pasteurized kind of a thing. they do have a high content of dairy in their diets. Yeah.
I remember reading something about the Mongols, how they were some of the healthiest people that they found from basically their teeth lasted longer than other people's mm-hmm. areas, probably because of all the dairy. They just eat horse meat, milk, and
yep.
all kinds of stuff, but for they live. Time.
Yep, makes sense.
I think they made that connection to the dairy in the study area.
Yep. So let's go on to the next one. Green leafy veggies, no surprise. Who said you don't like green leafies? Why not?
They're gross.
They're delicious. They're some of the best, yummiest things. High fiber, high calcium, high carotenoids. One of the reasons carotenoids are really important is why? Protect our eyes, protect our skin from sunlight, from sun damage. I don't really need to say too much more about green leafy vegetables. But get more of them in your diet. This is one of my favorites. I like them because they taste good, and I like them because they are one of my favorite healthy sources of flavonoids, with 3 exclamation points up here. The more that we know and understand about how flavonoids work in the body, the more they're almost miracle nutrients, miracle phytonutrients. They're anti-cancer, anti-Alzheimer's, anti-diabetes. They're good for the heart. They're good for blood vessel health. They're good for, you name it, they're good for it. And we just simply don't get enough of them. So flavonoids are one of the reasons that a lot of those beans are healthy. Flavonoids are the reasons that citrus is healthy. Flavonoids are the reason that berries are healthy. You really can't say a bad thing about them. There are things that you can supplement with, which I'll talk about in a little while. But this is one of the healthiest, yummiest food sources. Any questions about berries?
Yeah. There are a lot of people who promote juice from berries.
Yeah.
And they charge you an enormous amount of money.
Yep.
It's high concentration. That's the shtick.
Yep.
Tell me about it.
Yeah, so I've worked for a lot of those companies before and consulted with them and done research for them. They're right, so if you drink an acai juice, which is, like a Brazilian blueberry kind of, you're going to get a lot of flavonoids there. If you eat them, you're going to get them, right? There's no real benefit to getting them in a juice versus getting them in a handful of berries. It's just a matter of, do you get them or do you not get them, right? If you did a study, so you can do studies, and I've done some of these studies to show, if you get none of them, this is what happens. If you get a lot of them, good things happen. And that good thing, getting a lot of them can come from the juice, can come from a supplement. You can put those same kinds of things into a pill. You can take them fresh like this. You're going to get all of the same benefits.
It's not the key. It's just
getting them. Yeah, getting them. Because a lot of the clinical trials that are done, some of the clinical trials that are done on intake. They'll look at how many servings of raspberries or blueberries or blackberries that you get, every day or every week or every month, or some of the studies are years long. Some of the studies though, excuse me, are over shorter periods of time with higher concentrations. So you can get a pint of blueberries in a capsule in terms of flavonoid content, right? And then you can follow those people over a short period of time, like a month, versus having to show over blueberry consumption over a year or over a lifetime. Okay, so, but then the question is, do you want to spend $140 or $150 for a case of those expensive juices, or do you want to buy blueberries, right? That's the equation that you're trying to figure out. Either one would be equally beneficial for your health. Okay? Yeah?
Again, question, is there, do you have any idea on serving size? Does it just depend on the person? Or?
Yeah, well, I would love everyone to get like a small handful of blueberries every single day, or the equivalent. You don't like blueberries?
Oh, I eat a ton of them.
Yeah.
But I eat a lot more than that.
No, that's all you need. That's the dose. So a colleague of mine at Tufts a few years ago figured out that a half a cup of blueberries a day What was his calculation? He did this study in mice, but calculated to humans. And it was something like, it was more than 5 years, 6, 7, 8 years of longevity from getting a half a cup of blueberries every day. It was gigantic, amazing effect.
Are frozen ones okay?
Yeah, that's a good question. Frozen ones are fantastic because you can buy a big old bag of those, keep in your freezer, and throw a handful in your smoothie in the morning. Or put them in the microwave and warm them up and throw them in your oatmeal or throw them on your cereal or...
Top of ice cream.
Exactly. Now you're talking.
Sometimes is it a worry, though, if you take the berry as a juice, you get a spike in insulin because you're getting so much more all at once?
If it's a concentrated juice, yeah, that is, because now you're getting none of the fiber, you're getting all of the sugar, you're still getting all the flavonoids, right? So from a flavonoid perspective, that's not it. That's why I think it's better to, you know, just throw a handful of these in your Vitamix and get it that way. That would be the ideal way.
John, what did you say? Half a cup a day will add what?
Something like, and I don't remember the exact calculation, but like 5 to 8 years of longevity.
Wow.
Calculated from these mice that were eating them.
Sweet.
Every day, yep. Yeah.
Is there a place you buy cranberries? I love cranberries, but you can't get them anywhere.
You can't get cranberries. Like, cranberries are a very seasonal sort of thing.
They have a lot of sugar in them.
They do have a lot of sugar in them, yeah. Cranberries are disgusting, right? They're too bitter to eat.
Yeah, but if you mix them with like other berries.
You have to mix them with other berries, or you have to throw them in some food, or throw them in a smoothie with other stuff in there.
Thanksgiving, but I'm out.
Yeah, and they're hard to find outside of Thanksgiving. You know, they're a seasonal thing.
Now, cranberry water that you can do. Take the cranberry juice and drink it all day, and it helps your gallbladder.
Green tea is one of my absolute favorite drinks. Is that what you're drinking right now? So any tea, you know, black teas, oolong teas, anything from the leaf of the tea plant, the Camellia sinensis. The two reasons that I really like it is that catechins, the very specific kind of flavonoid. So there's flavonoids in berries. There's flavonoids in black beans. This is a particular flavonoid class that is profoundly anti-cancer. We did a study for a company down in Provo, gosh, this is 10 or 12 years ago now, where we showed that we were able to take cancer cells and give them catechins, apply catechins to them in a dish, the catechins killed the tumor cells as effectively as any of the chemotherapy drugs that were out there at the time. There's some other chemotherapy drugs that work in different ways now, but and we went to the company and said, look at what we found. And then we were able to do some mouse studies, right? Some rat studies, where the rats that drank green tea in their water, their tumors disappeared. It's terrible studies to do. You can induce tumors in these rodents, so they get these big nasty skin tumors that you can actually visually see, and they go away. They disappear when they drink green tea as their water source. They were drinking a lot of green tea. They were drinking it as their primary source of hydration, but it was miraculous stuff. So we went back to the company and said, look, it works as effectively as chemotherapy drugs on an isolated cancer cell. It makes the tumors disappear in this animal model. We need to go to the next level and start giving it to people who have cancer. And they canceled the research project. And we're like, why? This is good stuff. They're like, yeah, we know it's good stuff, but we can't use it. Because the way that regulations around dietary supplements are, they had a very effective green tea supplement in a pill, and we use their material to show these effects. They said, we can't talk about cancer. We can talk about cellular protection. We can talk about an antioxidant effect. We can talk about the level of catechins that we have. But as soon as we say cancer, the government comes after us. FDA comes after us, right? And it would shut us down. So, I mean, I get it. I understand completely why they canceled the research project, because we were getting too close to showing a medicinal effect of a plant. And that was something that's not allowed, right? You're laughing, and it's just like you're laughing because it's sad, right? It's completely ridiculous. So you can get this sort of an effect, this anti-cancer effect, But you can also get a really nice anti-stress effect from the theanine that's in there. And I have the theanine in these cookies that we'll talk about later. Theanine is an amino acid that's in green tea that gives a really nice calming effect. It doesn't make you drowsy unless you take it at a high level. But for most people, if you take it at a sort of a low level, 50 milligrams is the level that we have in those cookies, it puts you in a state that I refer to as relaxed alertness. Right, so you're sort of in a zone where you can focus, you can get work done, you're not anxious, you're not jittery. And this is one of the reasons, this theanine amino acid is one of the reasons that you could give somebody 100 milligrams of caffeine as tea and they would just kind of be energetic and good. But if you gave them the same 100 milligrams as coffee that doesn't have that theanine, they'd be jittery. Okay, because that theanine doesn't counteract the caffeine, but it takes the edge off the jitteriness or the anxiety effect that some people can get.
Source
doesn't matter. So you can use it in a purified form. You can extract it from green tea leaves, or the version that we use in here is actually...
I assume that with green tea, like if you... like green tea, you just put your packets in the water.
Yeah, just like the...
It doesn't matter if you do it hot, cold, just...
Nope, doesn't matter at all. So you can get your catechins and your theanine from the tea bag. You can get it from fancy tea. You can get it from cheap tea. It all is good from that perspective. The taste is going to be different, right? A cheaper tea and a more expensive tea are going to taste different. Different tea processing will you know, if it's fermented or fermented lightly or not fermented at all, you know, those kinds of things can change the flavor profile, but won't dramatically change the content here.
Does it come not caffeinated?
Yeah, so if you decaffeinate the tea, you lose some of the theanine. And so, you know, I tend to say to people, you know, tea is not that high in caffeine. Like a cup of most green teas is going to be 30 or 40 milligrams of caffeine, which is... you know, a cup of Starbucks, like a Starbucks Grande, probably has 200, 220, 230 milligrams of caffeine. So it's a very different level of caffeine load between coffee and tea. Okay. I was going to say something else about theanine. Yeah.
I just have a question.
Yeah.
So my husband drinks this tea that's by Monster.
Uh huh.
And. I've been on him for this.
Yeah.
He's like, it's tea, Marilyn, it's tea. So is that okay?
Probably not. Right? Well, I don't know. I mean...
I was like, all the other things that are in it, and then I was looking at it... And
is it real tea, though?
It is. It's black tea.
Okay.
It's like, yeah, something black, blah, blah, blah. Tea.
Okay.
And then, obviously, there's some other things in it.
Yeah.
But, yeah, he loves it.
Yeah. Well, I don't know what else is.
I
don't know what else is going to be in that product. Like, is it? Does it have a lot of sugar in it? Does it have? I don't know what else it might have in it. This is tea, also. This drink that I'm going to share with you tonight is a tea, right? It has a tea base,
yeah.
And then we brew it with some other nutraceuticals.
Okay.
But it might be a similar thing to this. So if he likes that, and if it really is tea, then it might be a decent thing.
Some other source.
Yeah, I'm not a big energy drink fan because the standard energy drink, right, is just a big sugar bomb.
Yeah.
You know.
That's a good point, though. Does the tea color matter? Green tea superior, black tea?
From this perspective, from a catechin perspective, probably not. Green tea, black tea, and oolong tea, which is kind of tan tea, it's kind of in between those two. Catechin level is going to be about the same. You're going to lose a little bit of theanine. So green tea is the highest in theanine. Oolong's is a little bit less. Black is a little bit less. So if you're going for theanine, you want to go green. And if you want to go catechins, they're all going to be pretty similar. Okay? Yeah?
So being a society who drinks a lot of tea like Britain,
yeah.
Do they have lower cancer rates?
They do, and even more so, Asian populations that drink tea. So England probably doesn't have enough of a tea dose for the anti-cancer effect to be seen population-wide. But someplace like China and Japan, they do, because they drink tea at every meal. You know, the English stereotypically are going to have it at tea time, right? You know, they'll have it at breakfast maybe, they'll have it at 3 o'clock. But Asians are going to drink it at breakfast, lunch, dinner, in between, all the time. And so that's enough of a drip, drip, drip of catechins all the time, where their incidence of all forms of cancer are much lower than someplace like the United States, which doesn't drink a lot of tea at all.
So does science corroborate that?
Yes, yes. Those are gigantic population studies. Okay. Yeah, it's a really, really good effect. You know, so much so that, you know, some people have said, health professionals have said, you know, if people switched out their morning cup of coffee for a morning cup of tea, it would be good for whatever health parameter, right? That makes some sense, except for the fact that coffee is also very high in flavonoids. It's not on my list because it's not something that's consumed at a high level in any of those blue zones. But it, you know, ounce for ounce, coffee is just as high in flavonoids as tea is. Just these catechin flavonoids in particular are known for their anti-cancer effect. Does that make sense? Okay. So my next one are two of my absolute favorite spices, so much so that I travel with these. I take a little container of ginger and a little container of turmeric with me when I go on a long trip, and I sprinkle them on stuff. Does anybody use these? I put them on everything. I'll go to Subway, and I'll get a turkey sandwich, and I'll sprinkle it with ginger and turmeric, and then slap it to clothes and eat it. Huge anti-inflammatory effect, huge anti-pain effect, analgesic, and huge anti-cancer effect. Turmeric, I think turmeric is probably tied with the catechins from green tea in terms of the number of scientific studies that show an absolute anti-cancer effect of those two nutrients, right? So the more of those you can get in your diet, the better. They're really easy to add to things. People don't use them a lot, though, because they're pretty potent flavors. They can be certainly used, small amounts of them, to spice up almost anything. We find them in curry, we find them in Indian foods, we find them in, you know, lots of sort of exotic, highly spiced foods, but there's no reason that we can't just spend a couple of dollars and have a little container of them and just add them to all sorts of things. Add them to soups, add them to stews. Yeah.
What is the shelf life of spices in general?
Yeah, that's a good one. Probably a year, right? A lot of spices should carry an expiration date on them. But what happens with spices is you buy a jar of it for the recipe that you're making, and then it goes into the cabinet, never to be seen again. And then you pull it out 3 years later.
Tastes good.
It will have some taste, right? It's less, the taste is less potent a year later. The health benefit is less potent a year later, because these compounds, you know, curcumin and ginger rolls, they'll break down over time. So, you know, you almost want to go through your spice cabinet, you know, seasonally, like you would go through your medicine cabinet and get rid of things that are expired, you know, but we don't, you know, a lot of times, but we should.
It's
a good question. I like McCormick. You know, they'll have a huge spice section. They're like one of the mainstream spice purveyors. I just like them because they're affordable. They're widely distributed. And McCormick at least hires scientists to study some of this kind of stuff. You know, about health benefits and things like that. So.
To get the benefit from those.
Yeah, you know, if you look at research studies that have looked very specifically at like an anti-inflammatory effect, you're looking at 500 milligrams to 1,000 milligrams a gram, which is a big dose. But those are studies that are short-term studies. They're studies that are only lasting a month or 2 months or 3 months. So they're giving a big dose of something to see an effect in a short period of time. That's okay, but I think that if we think about like the sort of blue zone effect, right? That longevity effect. What you really want to get with any of these nutrients that I've talked about is a little bit of it every single day for a long period of time. That's really what nutrition is all about with these phytonutrients. It's not about, you know, the juice example you brought up before, you know, take 2 ounces of this juice every day because it's a really high concentration. It's better than not, but probably even better than that would be to get a lower concentration over a longer period of time. You know, little bit, little bit, little bit, little bit, little bit every single day. That's what diets are. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
So this is going to be weird, but I have been reading on Pinterest, of course, about turmeric milk or golden milk, whatever they call it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've started making that every night. So just if somebody's looking for a good way to do turmeric and ginger, just like chop it up, boil it in some milk for 10, 15 minutes and drink it.
And then do you leave the turmeric root in there?
Sometimes.
Okay.
Sometimes I munch it and sometimes I don't.
That's great.
And I've read that pepper is supposed to help it absorb better. So
yeah, that's a pepper. Pepper does make it absorb better.
Yeah, and I throw in some like cinnamon and local honey.
Yeah, you don't like the taste of it?
It's not bad. It's not bad at all.
Yeah. And it's certainly an acquired taste.
It's sweet. It's at the same time. But you know, it's nice warm milk, so it makes you relax. You sleep better.
Yep, yep. Do you know why you sleep better with that? Warm milk, right? That's an old wives' tale, right?
Yeah.
Warm milk before bed makes you sleep better? It does. Does anyone know why?
Say that again, warm milk.
Warm milk before bed? You know, it's that old wives' tale about, you know, give the kids some warm milk before they go to bed, they'll sleep better. They do sleep better. There's a scientific reason for it. When we digest that casein, there are these little peptides, little 5 to 9 amino acid proteins that can get absorbed. Usually we think that amino acids have to be free amino acids or dipeptides in order to be absorbed, but these 5 to 9 length amino acids do get across, and they do travel to the blood-brain. They cross the blood-brain barrier. They have a relaxation effect on the body. So you have this nice sort of calming effect from that milk, and you drop off to sleep. Different effect than theanine, but it works.
Not the same if you put chocolate in.
It could be. A little bit of carbohydrate before bed is actually a good thing. I did a Fox News thing one time about spices to help you relax, or spices in general. And I had at the end of the table, I had these relaxation spices. I had chamomile, and I had, what else did I have? I had some dairy, and I had some carbohydrate sources. And the point I was trying to make was, if you take a little bit of carbohydrate before you go to bed, 10 grams maybe, right? 40 calories, just a little bit of carbohydrate, like a couple of crackers worth of carbohydrate, it would help you absorb things like that peptide that I just said. You can make a little tea like you just described with the turmeric milk, and it would help you relax. And so we're going through the whole thing, we went across the whole table, and then the announcer, you know, the interviewer, she goes, okay, great, so make sure, she looks at the camera and goes, make sure you give the kids some sugar tonight before they go to bed, and they went off to the next segment. I was like, no, that's not the point I was trying to make. But it's if you take a little bit of carbohydrate, you're gonna have a relaxation effect. If you take a lot of carbohydrate, like a chocolate milk, you're gonna get that sort of sugar hype kind of a thing. Okay. All right, citrus. You guys have heard the recommendation to try to eat a rainbow every day. Have you heard that before? You're supposed to eat something red and something orange and something yellow and something blue and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Why is that?
Variety.
What's indicative of the? Why wouldn't you just go out and say, all right, I'm gonna eat 5 grapefruits today, right? That's it's probably 10 servings actually of fruits. Why would you rather have a grapefruit and a blackberry and a green leafy and a you know, et cetera, et cetera? Why do you want each of those different colors? What do those colors indicate?
Antioxidants.
Yeah, different phytonutrients. The reason that a red pepper is red is because of one phytonutrient. The reason a blueberry is blue is because of a different phytonutrient. And the fact that you can get all of those together is sort of the idea we were talking about before of a little bit of everything every single day over years and years of your dietary intake. So citrus is one great way to do that. So people usually think of citrus as a vitamin C source, and it is. It's a very rich source of vitamin C. The flavonoids here help protect and extend the duration of that vitamin C in your body. So vitamin C is a very good antioxidant, specifically against these water-soluble kinds of free radicals. But once the vitamin C interacts with a free radical, like hydrogen peroxide or something like that, it's reduced. It's dead. It can't fight against another free radical. The flavonoids can regenerate that vitamin C so it can fight again, and then fight again, and then fight again. So if you're taking vitamin C, like you take a vitamin C pill, that's fine. It's better than no vitamin C. But if you get it in a matrix of these flavonoids, you're going to have a much more effective antioxidant effect. Another reason is that you get these PMFs, polymethoxylated flavones. These are found in, see this white part of the, like just under the peel, that sort of pericarp kind of a part of the fruit. That's where the PMFs are. So I'll generally tell people to, when you peel your citrus fruit, eat some of that white stuff, because there's a very specialized kind of flavonoid, these PMFs, that can lower cholesterol and lower cortisol. We found this cortisol effect almost by accident. So we did a study a couple of years ago where we were giving people PMFs in a pill to lower cholesterol. And we found that over 8 weeks, I think the study was, the dose of PMFs they were giving lowered their cholesterol about 20%, right? So pretty good cholesterol lowering effect. Cortisol, stress hormone, also went down about 15%. You know, so that was an effect that we weren't anticipating, but that can be very, very effective. This can be a heart health effect when you're lowering cholesterol, but this can be a belly fat effect when we're lowering cortisol. And you can get that, right? You've heard the grapefruit diet kind of a thing. There's something to that, you know, that these PMFs and these flavonoids in these citrus fruits can actually have this general metabolic benefit for people. Okay?
So you don't give them, like, for example, if you're slicing a grapefruit in half and you
eat the little sections?
Yeah, so you don't get them.
Yeah, so you won't get the PMFs. You'll get the other flavonoids, and you'll get the C, and you'll get the fiber, but you're not going to get those PMFs unless you get a little bit of that white stuff. So, okay? But they're really, really good. They're very potent, and they're very healthy. And then this is the last of my healthy foods, and then I'll talk about the snacks that I have up here. Red wine. Who's heard of resveratrol before, right? This was the hottest thing about 2 years ago. And everybody was buying resveratrol. It was sold out everywhere. You couldn't get it. One of the reasons that resveratrol is, I have a question mark here as an antioxidant. It might not actually be an antioxidant on its own. Very similar to the flavanols from cocoa, right? You guys have heard that dark chocolate is good for you, right? Because it's an antioxidant. That actually might not be true. A lot of these flavonoid compounds that we used to think are antioxidants in a test tube probably aren't antioxidants in the body. But what they can do is turn on these kinds of things. They can activate different pathways inside cells that induce an antioxidant effect. So if we're talking about resveratrol specifically, there's a pathway in the body called NRF2, which turns on your body's ability to make its own antioxidants. There's a pathway called SIRT1 that is generally thought of as kind of a longevity pathway. The more you can activate that, the longer you live. And that's been shown in worms, it's been shown in flies, it's been shown in rodents, it's been shown in lots of species. And we think that, you know, those populations that are drinking red wine, one of the reasons they're long-lived is because they're activating this on a regular basis. And then NF-kappa B is an anti-inflammatory pathway. So you can activate that and get an antioxidant effect, a longevity effect, and an anti-inflammatory effect just because you're drinking your red wine, right? So that's good news. Do you think we'd get the same effect if we just ate the grapes? Or if we drank grape juice?
Yeah, the fermentation.
Right, so does it? That's the question. What's the fermentation going to do? It's going to give you alcohol. You know, so, I mean, that's a thing. That alcohol might help with the absorption. of the flavonoids. Similar to what we were talking about before with, you know, having a little bit of fat to absorb your fat-soluble vitamins. This alcohol might help us absorb those flavonoids at a higher level. Might not. There are some studies that show that if you get a low-sugar grape juice, because most of the grape juice that you're going to find on the shelf is going to be packed full of sugar. But if you have a low-sugar grape juice that is equivalent to that wine in terms of flavonoid content, you're getting the same sort of an effect. It's just a matter of access to that sort of a thing. And then eating grapes, it's a dose kind of a thing. So the amount of resveratrol that some of these studies are looking at is looking at like 40 bottles of wine in terms of the amount that they're giving in a supplemental form, right? So try drinking 40 bottles of wine. It might be fun to try to do that. But do you think that's a good thing, supplementing at that level? No, it's a bad thing. I wrote a book called Deadly Antioxidants that talks about just that, and resveratrol is a perfect example of it. If we take a little bit, like a glass of wine, if we take a little bit, like a serving of grapes, like a bowl of grapes, you're going to get a low dose of resveratrol. Going back to that idea that I've been harping on, a little bit every single day over a long period of time, health benefit, longevity benefit, well-being benefit. But resveratrol, we've seen some studies come out in the last couple years where when you supplement at those high levels, not only are you not getting that antioxidant effect, you're interfering with these pathways and you're actually causing an oxidation. You're causing more inflammation because you're shutting off those pathways. You're shutting off the body's ability to respond on its own. And so those very high doses of C or E or resveratrol or any of them, when you take them at those mega doses, you're actually not protecting yourself. You're causing more damage. You're causing more of the damage that you're trying to reduce in the first place. So it's a disconnect for a lot of people. It's a very classic. If I had a whiteboard here, I would draw an upside down U, right? It's the classic biological response where, you know, you have a low level of something. A deficiency state is bad, and you start going up the dosing, and you get better, 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 better effect. And somewhere there's a tipping point where it starts to get worse. So antioxidants and anti-inflammatory nutrients fall right into that biological balance point, right? If we don't get enough, it's bad. If we get too much, it's bad. And we need to get right in the middle somewhere. Yeah?
Just take one supplement per week. Still too much all at once?
Well, no, so I'm an advocate of supplements. I think people should supplement, but at a really, really low level. So resveratrol is something I don't supplement with. Resveratrol is something where, like, I do prefer to get it from wine. I do prefer to get it from grapes. I do prefer to get it from those sorts of foods. But there are things that I do supplement with, like vitamin D. We can't get that at high enough levels in order to have a beneficial effect, so I supplement with that. I supplement with other kinds of flavonoids because, you know, even though I'd like to eat berries every single day, I don't. You know, so I do supplement with some flavonoids that way. I do recommend people take just sort of a general multivitamin, you know, but that is, you know, that's going to be 100% of the daily value. It's not going to be some of these vitamins that are out there that have 1,000 or 10,000%, right? That more is not better. The more is clearly worse now, and we have very good data to show that.
What's your favorite multi?
What is my favorite? So I take one by a company called New Chapter. They sell a lot of their products at Whole Foods. An independent place like Sherlin's or someplace like that would carry New Chapter. They make a men's version. They make a women's version. One of the things I like about them is that they have a philosophy of using a lot of herbal extracts and whole plant, whole food kinds of sources. And the reason why that is, I think, is a good approach is that you're not getting to some of those high levels. Like, you know, you could look at a Centrum, you could look at a One a Day, and those are good sort of general, basic, cover the bases, you know, make sure that you're not having any deficiencies kind of products. If you want to go a little bit more advanced and have some herbs and have some, you know, some adaptogens to help you protect against stress and some herbals that help you with inflammation and things like that, New Chapter is a good approach. So, okay. All right, so do you guys want to talk about these treats? Are there any questions about those top tens? Yeah.
Have you heard of the new research that's out regarding digestion and certain foods? It's called the FODMAP.
I don't know that.
FODMAP diet.
And no.
Some research out of Australia who found complications with people with IBS and just different foods and the different sugars and how they react to the body.
Yeah, I don't know that specifically, but IBS is a big problem for a lot of people. IBS, irritable bowel syndrome, is something that exists on a huge continuum, right? There can be people who have, and there's all kinds of different types of IBS. There's IBS when you have diarrhea, there's IBS when you have constipation, there's IBS when you just have gas and bloating and stomach aches and things like that. But IBS is one of those things that it's really hard to figure out. It's not just a dietary thing, right? It's not just a diet gut kind of a thing. IBS can be affected by how much sleep you get, how much stress you're under, what your environmental exposure to air pollution and things like that are. There's lots and lots of things that can affect it. So it's frustrating for people to figure out, because sometimes you can figure out, oh, I've got it. I changed my diet and I'm good. And you'll be good for a couple of days and then you'll be bad again. And it's really hard to figure out what your triggers are. And it's a very individualized kind of a thing. You know, some people will do fine with dairy, some will do fine with carbohydrates, some will do poorly with any manner of thing. So it's a little bit of a black box for a lot of people. So, but I'm not familiar with that one particular approach that you mentioned. All right, so let's talk about these snacks that are up here. So we're going to do a study in May. When did we decide we're going to start that? May? June?
3rd, and we did the testing around that.
Okay. So end of May-ish, we're going to run it for 6 weeks, and we're going to measure all sorts of, we're going to measure body weights, we're going to measure waist circumferences, we're going to measure different psychological parameters.
Muscle density or muscle quality.
Muscle density, body fat percentages. Based on this idea, drink tea, eat cookies, feel great. Who's in? Right? That sounds pretty good, right? And that's based on some research that we've already done. So we're just going to try to. I've studied each of the three main ingredients in the cookies, these stress cookies, separately, and now this study is going to test them all at the same time. And I've already studied this tea as it sits in front of you right now. So in November last year, I presented a study at the American College of Nutrition, and I'll present another set of the data at American College of Sports Medicine next month in Boston, that showed this, that the compounds that are in that tea are able to reduce negative mood state and increase positive mood state. So here's a printout where you guys can see what's in here.
Is it like the recipe?
It's not a recipe, but it's like a nutrition facts panel. So this is the tea.
Okay.
Yep. 2 pages for the tea. And then when I get to the cookies, I'll give you another one. But in this tea, there's 2 flavors. There's a mango peach and there's a fruit punch. And so each one of these, before I forget to tell you, I'm going to give you guys all samples of this. Each 16-ounce bottle is 4 servings. Okay? Do not drink a whole bottle. It will not make you feel less stressed. It'll make you feel like you won't sleep for the next week. So just drink 4 ounces, right? So you're gonna have to kind of eyeball it. 4 ounces is about down to there. Then down to halfway, then you'll be able to see. When we gave people 4 ounces of this, and we compared it to a placebo, something that looked like this that didn't have the actives in it, we saw a profound drop in stress, tension, anxiety, and irritability. We saw a profound increase. So these went down. The negative mood state went down 74%, right? Huge, huge change. Noticeable after 15 minutes. So we measured people's mood state every 15 minutes from time point 0 to time point 2 hours. And we saw the first significant data point at the first time point, 15 minutes. 15 minutes, 30 minutes, 45 minutes, etc. So negative mood state was down. Positive mood state went up 100% in all of these subjects. Mood, focus, energy, well-being. So people clearly feel better when they're taking this. And it's not... Yes?
Is that
a 4-day supply or a 1-day supply?
This is a 4-day supply. Okay. Yep. So generally the way that I take this, every morning when I get up, I take this out of the refrigerator, I start making my coffee, get the coffee pot going, I hit start on the coffee, I drink 4 ounces of this, right? That gets me ready for the day, lets me get on my computer, lets me do my emails, do a little bit of writing, whatever the case may be. And then often I work out in the morning, so I'll just go and work out. If I work out in the afternoon, I'll take another 4 ounces of this before my workout, right? So some days I'm just taking 4, some days I'm taking 8, depending on what my day looks like, okay? So stress, tension, anxiety, irritability went down. Mood, focus, energy, well-being went up. We also saw, because the base of this is green tea, we saw a 5% increase, 3 to 5% increase, depending on the person, in RMR, resting metabolic rate. So, and you would perfectly expect that from the amount of green tea that's in here, that there's enough catechins in there to increase fat burning, increase calorie expenditure. So people have said to us, like, all right, when you guys start marketing this, is it going to be an energy drink? Yes, because we found that. Is this going to be a weight loss drink? Yes, because we found a metabolic rate improvement. Is this going to be a pre-workout kind of a thing? Yes, because you're going to feel better when you do your workouts, right? It's sort of all of those things. So you guys will have to judge how you guys want to use it. Do you want to use it before your workouts? Do you want to use it before your day starts? But I want to give you guys samples of that. 2 different flavors. The cookies... Oh, so here are the ingredients in the tea. I want to talk about these a little bit. American ephedra. Has anybody ever heard of ephedra before?
Yeah.
Yes. What do you know about ephedra?
Not good things.
Not good things? Why?
It got a bad rap.
It got a bad rap.
Yeah.
I think people were just pumping it into weight loss supplements.
Yes, exactly.
Isn't
that
crazy doses?
Yep. So... back in the day, so this was, Chinese ephedra was banned in 2004 maybe. Okay, so more than 10 years ago. It was in Metabolife, it was in Ripped Fuel, it was in everything, right? And people were taking lots of it. And the thing that was great about it, has anyone ever taken Chinese ephedra, old ephedra? What did you like about it? Did you like it?
Oh, it made you feel so good.
Yeah, so good in what way?
Just like, you felt like you could conquer the world, like your workouts.
You got awesome workouts.
Yeah, crazy workouts.
You weren't hungry. Yeah. It burned fat. It was awesome. Unfortunately, people were like, yeah, I want to feel like that all the time. I'm going to take, they just started gobbling it down.
And then you get dependent on it.
And then your heart exploded, right? I mean, that's why I get taken off the market, because, you know, there were people who would take too much of it, they'd OD on it. You'd get high blood pressure, you'd get heart palpitations. So when it got taken off the market, I was an expert witness in 3 of the main litigations that happened. And so my standard thing was to say, yeah, you know, some people will take it and get exactly what you just described. Good energy, good weight loss, they love it, they do really well with it. Some people will take it and go, meh, I didn't really notice anything. And then some people would take it and have a problem. Their blood pressure would go through the roof. Their heart would go crazy. It would just not be a good match for them. And so you don't know who you are until you take it. And if you're that last guy and you have a problem and you have a heart attack and some people died, bad news. So this ephedra is a completely different plant. It's in the same botanical species. And so that's why it's still called ephedra. But Chinese ephedra and American ephedra are so different chemically that this one's legal and allowed, whereas the Chinese one is banned. So this one doesn't really give you the same fat loss benefit that the other stuff did, but it gives a very different kind of brain benefit. It has these very specialized amino acids that help with mental focus. And this, we think, is one of the reasons why we're getting such a rise in positive mood and a drop in negative mood, is because of that American ephedra in there. We combine that with New Zealand pine bark. We combine that in a base of green tea, and you can see the other ingredients here and what their function is. But that whole matrix mixed together gives a really, really nice sort of balancing effect. And that's why I call it stress tea, because it's really helping you in the day when you take this. One of the problems with being under stress in the day is that it makes us irritable and fatigued and we can't concentrate. You take this stress tea in the day and you're able to be energized and focus and be motivated and be happy and get your stuff done. When we're stressed out at night, in the evening, like this time of night when we're stressed out, we end up getting irritable and tense and anxious, and we can't relax. And so these stress cookies have a different blend of nutrients in them that don't make you drowsy, but relax you. So that if you still have work to do, you can get your work done. If you're ready to go to sleep, you're relaxed enough so you can fall asleep. So here are the four ingredients here. Theanine, which we talked about before, that nice relaxing amino acid that's not going to make you drowsy, but is going to take the edge off and put you in that sort of relaxed state. Japanese asparagus extract, this increases the body's stress resilience. So like right down at the cellular level, you're producing more of what are called heat shock proteins, stress response proteins, so you can become more resilient to the stress that's around you. New Zealand pine bark extract, which is also in the tea, that is helping with some of that neurochemistry. So here, it's a balancing effect. If you're tense and restless, it's going to calm you down. If you're unfocused and unmotivated, it's gonna activate you. So it's really a sort of a balancing effect that we're getting from this really high concentration of these specialized flavonoids called OPCs, these oligomeric proanthocyanidins. And then this corngrass extract. This is one of my favorite supplements right now. We did a study a few years ago that looked at just this as a sleep aid. And what we found in the study was that people fell asleep a little bit faster, they stayed asleep a little bit longer, but the really cool thing was no matter how many hours they slept, whether they slept 8 hours or 7 hours or 6 hours, they spent more of that time in REM sleep, in the deepest restful stages of sleep. So it really helped the brain relax and get into those deep stages, which is important because that's where you get the restorative, recuperative qualities of sleep. If you're in light sleep all night long, it doesn't matter how many hours you're in bed, you're not going to be rested when you get up. Does that make sense to everybody? So it's not like a melatonin or a valerian. It doesn't make you sleepy. It doesn't make you drowsy, but when you're ready to sleep, it helps you slip into those deeper stages. It helps with serotonin levels, which, you know, serotonin is generally thought of as like a happy neurotransmitter. But if your serotonin levels are out of balance, if they're high when they're supposed to be low and low when they're supposed to be high, you just feel off. So people can have high serotonin when it should be low and low serotonin when it should be high, and your circadian rhythm is off. This seems to help with circadian rhythms so that you're able to relax when you're supposed to relax and be awake when you're supposed to be awake, right? So but that's a complicated story to say. It's resetting your circadian rhythms. But that's what I think is happening. What's that? It is safe for kids. So my kids, whenever I make these cookies, you know, they'll see them and they'll go, "Can I have a cookie tonight?" You know, and sure, because, you know, for a kid, I would give them a half of a cookie. But for an adult, you know, definitely a half. What you're going to see with these, I don't think I brought enough for everybody. I brought enough for everybody to have one. These are peanut butter and these are dark chocolate. And what you'll notice with them is that when I give these out, I'll hand these out to everybody. There's one sheet for the dark chocolate nutrition facts and one sheet for the crunchy peanut butter nutrition facts. You'll see the four ingredients are in there. You'll see that there's a certain amount of carbohydrate in there for the reason I said before, that carbohydrates can actually help you relax a little bit if you get the right amount. There's some salt in there. Right? So when we're stressed out, we generally crave sweet and we crave salt. And so I made the cookies both that to shut off those signals, right? There's no way to willpower yourself out of that biochemistry, that once you're stressed out, you're going to get those and you need to eat them. So I'd rather have you eat this than a cupcake and a handful of potato chips, right? You can get a little bit of carb and a little bit of salt and shut off those signals. And, so they're not just cookies, right? How many grams of protein do we have in there? I think we have 10.
Yeah.
10 grams of protein. So good amount of protein, healthy carbohydrates, healthy fats. You can see that the fats come from avocado oil and coconut oil and red palm oil. So anyway, they're healthy cookies, healthy tea, drink tea, eat cookies, feel great. And we have some data to show that already. We're going to collect more data to support it a little bit more. Do you guys have questions?
How do you be part of the study?
Well, I think we're going to start recruiting people.
Yeah,
so
the advertisement will be out next week because it's the first week of May. So we'll have a binder at the activities desk. The flyers are going up. It'll be in the email blast, so next week all of it.
And so what we're going to do for we're going to give people this tea, and we're going to say drink 4 ounces every morning and eat one of these cookies every night, and we're going to track them over time for 6 weeks and measure mood states and measure all the things that I mentioned before. Because we want to measure sleep quality.
Yeah, they'll be Fitbit, and then they get a menu every week and a workout.
So are you marketing this to membership and staff?
Yeah.
And it's being marketed here.
Yeah.
And where does it begin?
Starting next week, all the marketing will come out. Yep.
Yeah, and we're going to announce it at the Women's Business Conference.
Yeah, we're doing a conference on May 10th, too, so outside members will be also welcome to. You don't have to be a member to try it.
Yeah, because stress is... I don't know what we... $250.
Yeah.
For the 6 week program, and that covers everything, including the Fitbit. Okay? One of the things with stress, you guys have heard me talk about stress before, it's a big problem that a lot of people just don't fully appreciate what it's doing to their bodies and waistlines and mood levels and things like that. But most people would just think there's nothing I can do about it, right? It doesn't do any of us any good to say, you need to control your stress. You need to get more sleep. You know, it's unrealistic for a lot of people to do that kind of stuff. So these are ways, you know, tea and cookie, you know, with these phytonutrients are a way that we can help people sort of take that edge off. And then if they sleep better, maybe they're more energetic the next day, so they make healthier choices. They exercise more, they eat the right foods, etc.
So you also marketing to buy just the tea and the cookies?
We might. So these aren't commercialized yet. Like, I mean, you can see these are unlabeled sort of prototypes, you know, but that's the end goal. You know, once we have enough data and we feel like, you know, the claims that I put up there are kind of substantiated, we'll put them out there. Okay?
So I think a lot of people would be interested in once they find that it's working to
right. Right, I think so.
And I would want to know, well, can I keep doing this, or 6 weeks, how do I get it?
Yeah, that's the objective. Hopefully we'll be able to do that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay?
I have a question on the drinks.
Yeah.
On the caffeine.
I'm sorry. Go ahead. Go ahead.
Okay.
My bad.
So my question is, okay, so I have fibromyalgia.
Yeah.
I'm on like Cymbalta and stuff, and that stuff says that it affects like serotonin. Like, how does that interact with those types of things?
Yeah. No, well, it's a So do you want to? Yeah, so that's the mango peach one.
Sure.
Do you want to take a cookie?
Sure.
Go ahead. So
gets one.
Dark chocolate peanut butter. Take whichever one you want. Yeah. So Cymbalta and those kinds of things work on some of those same pathways, right? So whether it's Cymbalta or Prozac or Wellbutrin or Zoloft or any of those, they're all in sort of the same family, if you will. I can't. Sure thing. I can't say how it's going to interact, if it's going to be good. We've done studies. Some of the studies we've done here where we've looked at. I'm not sure if we've looked at any of these except for theanine, maybe, in some of the anti-stress studies that we've done before. But what I'll generally tell people if they want to add a supplement and they're taking one of those kinds of serotonergic kinds of drugs is add it in, see how you're feeling. Go for a couple of weeks. Then if you decide that you're feeling good and you want to try to come down off of that medication, always best to do it with your doctor or your pharmacist. But people want to experiment. But what you don't want to do is go, I'm going to start taking the herb instead of my medicine and go cold turkey, right? You don't want to do that. But if you want to get on the supplement and then wean, you know, come down by a quarter, come down by a half, come down by three quarters, like that's the way to step yourself down if you're going to do that. But a lot of times what you'll find is that once you add an herb in, it sometimes will balance you to a point where the drug on its own isn't doing that. Like, we see that kind of thing all the time, that someone's taking a medication and they're like, yeah, I feel different, but I don't feel good. And then once they add an herb in, it's balancing them in a different way than the drug is, and now they feel good again. So, you know, sometimes it's the combination of that medication and the herb that does it for them.
Okay.
But very individualized, so I'm glad you asked that.
I was just wondering if you were like, no,
then which means? No, it's, sort of a, you know, if these were, these are all kind of food-based kinds of supplements anyway. There are some kinds of supplements that are more like herbal medicine, you know, so I don't have as big a concern with these as I would with some other things.
Okay, I would just, thank you.
Okay, and then you had a question.
Yeah, I'm just curious on the caffeine in these. If you're saying like 4 ounces, you know what
I mean? Yeah, so
the ingredient
or each 4 ounces has 100 milligrams of caffeine.
Okay.
Okay, which is about half of what you're going to get in a Starbucks grande coffee.
Okay.
Okay.
Is it comparable to like a Rockstar or a Red Bull or something?
Yeah, so
I don't drink any of those kind of drinks, but if someone were asking me and I'm trying to help promote this or whatever, and that's what they drink.
Yeah. So a Red Bull is usually about 80 milligrams of caffeine. Rockstars, Monsters are around 100 to 125. No, same. We use, you know, people ask us that time, they're like, yeah, there's caffeine in there, but it's natural caffeine, right? And I say, no, like, I've used natural caffeine in some products. This is synthetic caffeine for a very particular reason. It's absorbed quickly, and you get a noticeable rise in energy. What you're feeling overall with this, that mood state change, isn't due to the caffeine, but caffeine's important for the overall effect of the product. That makes sense. I want your husband to try this.
That's what I was like, I need this.
Yeah. So it's, you know, it's green tea based. It's, you know, it has this New Zealand pine bark, which is one of my favorite supplements.
Do you remember last time you were here and I told you that he drank Monster?
Yeah.
I was like, okay, tell me all the bad things about this. I think one of it was like low something along with sexual,
I don't know. Well, I mean, well, that's the way to get any guy to pay attention, right? Yeah. Well, a high sugar load can lead to problems with sexual performance, right? Because, you know, blood sugar, blood vessel dilations and things like that. So, maybe we talked about that. I can't remember exactly. But yeah, my biggest problem with those kinds of drinks is it's a sugar bomb, right? And liquid sugar is the worst way to take your sugar.
I guess is there sucralose in it or something, you know?
Yeah, and you know, so this has sucralose, right? That's the sweetener we have in here. Yep. We have a version, another prototype version that's sweetened with stevia. Mm-hmm. It's not quite there yet, right? One of the benefits of sucralose is that not only is it a sweetener, but it's a debitterizer. Mm-hmm. And so some of these herbs are very bitter in nature, and so it completely masks them.
Have you had anybody, because when I drink a lot of, or eat whatever, a lot of sucralose, I tend to crave more sugar.
Yeah.
And that happens to me.
Oh yeah, it happens to a lot of people, and a lot of artificial sweeteners will do that. Because what happens is your body has sensed sweetness, and so over time, you know, it's like, you know, the sweetness is the equivalent to 100 calories of sugar, right, in terms of sweetness. So your brain is thinking, oh, I had this hit of sweetness, I must have taken in 100 calories. Later on in the day, there's a deficit. Those 100 calories haven't registered in the body, and so your brain says, what happened to those 100 calories? We registered it here, but we didn't register it here. It ups your appetite to replace those 100 calories. And so you go and you search it out and you eat something sweet. Mm-hmm. So that happens. It happens more predominantly in some people versus other people, but it happens.
Like with this tea? Do you think with this tea?
No, I don't think we find that. Because, like, you know, I know people who have been taking this who are as lean as they've ever been, because I think I think the overwhelming effect is positive mood goes up, negative mood goes down, and you just feel good. And if you feel good, you're going to say, I'm going to be more physically active today. I'm going to exercise harder. I'm going to choose better. I'm going to eat those green leafies when I'm in a better mood versus when you're in a crappy mood and you want to eat donuts, right? So it's like that change in your mood state is a very very motivating kind of thing for a lot of people.
So excuse me, just that room.
Yeah.
Right here.
Go ahead.
So if somebody wants to participate in that study,
yeah,
then you would say eliminate the normal energy drink that people usually. I hydrate big, and I put a little bit of B12.
Yeah, I wouldn't say eliminate that kind of stuff, but I think what you're going to find is that you're going to have less of a, you're going to have less of an appetite for needing to reach for a Monster or needing to reach for a snack or something like that.
Monsters, but I do. I have one that has a high dose of B12, and it produces the same type of well-being
mm-hmm.
that you're describing.
Yeah.
You know, B12 is used on with cancer patients who. Going through this process of dying.
Yeah, so B12 is one of those general energy metabolism kinds of vitamins, right? All the B complex vitamins, but B12 in particular, because a lot of people have trouble absorbing B12. And so if you don't supplement with it at a high level, you're just not going to get enough of it into your body, even if you're supplementing with it, right? So that's why those high levels are sometimes needed. No, I don't think so. I don't think if you're getting a benefit from a B12 supplement, I don't think this is going to replace that effect.
Okay.
Sure thing. Yeah.
Really only have 150 calories. This feels like.
Yeah. So the peanut butter ones are slightly bigger than that, and
the
cookie one. No, not double. These should be 50 grams, and they're about 60 grams. And the chocolate one should be 50 grams, and they're about 40 grams. So they're just slightly bigger in the peanut butter, and just slightly smaller in the chocolate for this batch.
Calories?
Yep.
I think this would be. Like a Mrs. Phillips. Like.
Yeah, no, it's not. It's a fairly low level of fat. It's a fairly low gluten. Even though I said gluten intolerant isn't a thing, we went with the carbohydrate blend is lower in the wheat flour and higher in coconut flour and higher in rice flour and things like that that are non gluten containing flours. So, it's yeah. So it's not.
By the dozen.
We're going to sell them by the dozen. Yeah, we are going to sell them by the dozen. And you had a question. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I had a similar question to him. Just I'm someone who consistently takes pre-workout. If I was taking this, would I still take that pre-workout? Or
no, I would not take a pre-workout and this at the same time. That'd be too much load for you.
Okay.
So I would try to take this instead of, and just see how this isn't probably going to give you the charge that a traditional pre-workout is going to do. Like if you're taking a pre-workout that just gets you amped to go in there and just pound the weights, this isn't probably going to give you the same effect unless you took it at 8 ounces. Okay, you could try that.
Also, just one thing. Can you maybe look at this, just this pre-workout? This is something I've been taking for.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. Any other questions? All right, thanks a lot, you guys. Yeah, my pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Sure thing.
If the CECs, I will get to you. If you're desperate for them, I have alternatives. If I could just put you guys to help me get this stuff up. So put your chairs on that car. Greg's going to take the water. Make sure you put your drink a little. And then, you can also take your pen back.
Summer, what flavor do you want?